Hello, this is Book Club Cheats, a podcast for book clubbers who just can't seem to find the time to read. I'm your host, Lippy Turner Raman, and today we'll be talking about The Stationery Shop by Marjan Kamali. Recently, my daughter and I were reading All the Shah's Men by Stephen Kinzer, which details how the CIA and MI6 conspired to overthrow Mohammad Mossadegh, the first democratically elected prime minister of Iran, and restore the pro-Western Shah to power in 1953. Mossadegh promised his people their fair share of their country's natural resources by nationalizing the Iranian oil fields. The Americans, the British, and the Shah did not want to give up their monopoly, their power, and all that money. Marjan Kamali's The Stationery Shop tells the story of a pair of star-crossed lovers during that fateful period in Iranian-American history. In 2013, 77-year-old Iranian-American Roya Archer goes into a stationery shop while her husband Walter is having new orthopedic arches measured up and discovers that the shop is an exact replica of a stationery shop that she frequented in Tehran. Omid, the owner, tells Roya that his father, Bahman Aslan, was the force behind the shop and that he's in a retirement home nearby. Roya is seriously shaken. Roya and Bahman fell in love in that same Tehran stationery shop. Bahman had written countless love letters to Roya, had proposed to her under a lavender-coloured sky next to a jasmine-soaked bush, and had stood her up, left her standing in the square the day the soldiers and the mobs came to topple Mossadegh. Bahman, the boy who married another woman, and who she still loved. Walter tells Roya that she's a little bit of a mess, that she needs to sort herself out. So Roya makes an appointment and goes to ask Bahman the questions that have been in her head for 60 years, why he didn't show that day, and why he left her. Bahman is old, has wrinkles, is in a wheelchair, has Parkinson's, but his eyes are joyful and full of hope, and his voice makes Roya's heart beat faster and takes her back to 1953. Time contracts and expands at the same time. Roya is 17 and 77 simultaneously in that moment, and they are Bahman and Roya again. Bahman says he's been waiting for her, just as he waited all afternoon in the square 60 years ago, and asks why she never came. He speaks of the letter he received from Roya afterwards, where she told him that she couldn't marry him since she couldn't deal with his mother's mental illness. Roya rebuts him. No. He stood her up, and the letter that she received from him later spelled out that he's not ready to be married. He wanted to fight for the democratic cause and for her to move on with her life. Roya says she forgives Bahman for not turning up. An agitated Bahman wants to know which square she stood in. Roya replies, Serpa Square, just like he told her. No, no, Bahman tells Roya, I told you Behrestan Square. Roya thinks the poor man's totally lost his marbles and that he's totally mixed up, and she's sure thankful that Walter has all his faculties about him. Bahman tells her to come back again because there's so much history she doesn't know. So what happened? Who was supposed to be in what square that day, and why didn't Bahman turn up 60 years ago? The stationery shop is comprised of five parts, spanning the periods 1916 to 2013. At the beginning of part one, 77-year-old Roya and Bahman meet again, and our story segues to 1953, the year when 17-year-old Roya and Bahman fall in love. Tehran is filled with enthusiasm, an almost euphoria, a hope, a budding potential, and the eager anticipation of something momentous about to happen. Roya's father is a lowly government clerk, but he's a huge supporter of Prime Minister Mossadegh. Baba is enthused with the hope that the promises Mossadegh has made will help Iran to chart its own path and destiny, free of the grasp of Western interference, and make the lives of ordinary Iranians far, far better. Roya's father has big dreams for his two daughters too. They'll be great scientists like Marie Curie. Roya, the elder of the sisters, however, is more interested in literature. Both the Iranian and the translated European works found at the stationery shop. It's her favourite place in the whole world. One afternoon, she meets Bahman, the politically active student when he whirls into the store to collect Mossadegh political posters. Bauman is full of kinetic energy, brimming with hope and charisma. Mr. Thackeray, the owner of the stationery shop, tells Roya that Bauman is a boy who wants to change the world. Bauman and Roya meet every Tuesday at the stationery store, forging an intense connection and falling in love. Bauman introduces Roya to a world of new potentials, to new artistic, creative, and sophisticated and intellectual pursuits that are opening up in Mossadegh's Tehran. Bauman takes Roya to a political demonstration in the square. There's jostling between communists, pro-democracy groups, and right-wing monarchists, an exhilarating and frightening experience. Pro-Shah goons beat up Bauman and break his nose. Roya drinks Italian coffee and eats rich elephant ear pastries, Bauman's favourites, at an upscale cafe. The couple dance foreign dances and listen to foreign songs at Bauman friends Jahangir's social parties. Bauman takes Roya to watch The Bicycle Thief at the lush, old-world, glamour-filled Cinema Metropole. It's a magical and heady time for the lovers. After the movie, under a lavender sky and next to a jasmine-infused bush, Bauman asks Roya to marry him. They are so much in love, giddy with it, just like the country. So much to look forward to. There's a shadowing as a plot device in the stationery shop. In the square that the couple pass daily, a sad, mentally crushed woman dressed in red waits daily for the lover who abandoned her years ago. You just know something bad is going to go wrong. You just know it. Roya discovers all is not well in Bauman's household. Bauman's sad, quiet, and kindly father agrees to the marriage and welcomes Roya. Bauman's mother is a totally different kettle of fish. She wants nothing to do with Roya. Mrs. Aslan is obsessed with wealth, class, and status. She's temperamental, highly strung, erratic, and it quickly becomes obvious she has serious mental issues. Mrs. Aslan has already picked out rich, sophisticated Shala to be Bauman's bride and will do anything to make that happen. She attempts to emotionally blackmail Bauman not to marry Roya. At the engagement party, Roya sees Mr. Thackeray speaking with and pleading with Bauman's mother. Bauman asks Roya to be patient with his mother. Then, one day, Bauman and his parents disappear. Roya is scared and is convinced that the Shah's secret police have taken him into custody. Mr. Thackeray assures Roya Bauman is fine, that he just can't be with her right now. He has important matters to attend to. But Mr. Thackeray will act as go-between, pass letters between Roya and Bauman, concealed in the literature books. In Bauman's letters, he tells Roya that he misses her, wants to be with her, but cannot due to mitigating circumstances. One day, he writes that he cannot stand it any longer. They can get married at the register office if Roya meets him at the square on August 19th. At the square, demonstrators are amassing. The CIA's pro-Shah demonstrators arrive and violence ensues. But Roya keeps waiting for Bauman at the square. Suddenly, Mr. Thackeray runs out of his shop. He has something urgently to tell her and jerks his head to the other side of the square. A bullet hits Mr. Thackeray in the chest. He dies at her feet. Bauman never comes. Roya goes home dazed and traumatized. Page 121. Through the gate into the courtyard, past the koi pond and into the cool sanctuary of her house she went. Inside, her family was still deep in their afternoon nap. Maman's big bowl lay in the kitchen sink, the one in which she always served the chicken and the poon koresh stew. Zari lay wrapped in her samant cotton sheet in bed. In the next room, Baba snored and Maman lay next to him, her slippers lined up neatly on the floor. Everyone was accounted for, safe. Her family had no idea what was happening in the squares of Tehran, the forces making its way north, the danger of the crowd. They did not know Mr. Thackeray's fate. They could not smell the smoke from the stationery shop. They had their chicken and spoon stew with rice and had taken their afternoon nap as if it was any other day. And Bauman was nowhere to be found. Had she really gone to the square expecting to see him, with a rose in his hand, wearing his crisp white shirt, ready to whisk her away so that they could get their marriage papers? It seemed vaguely amusing now to think she could have had these expectations. When her family awoke and turned on the radio, they would learn that the mob had made its way all the way to the home of Prime Minister Mossadegh. People had scaled the walls and entered his house. Mossadegh had managed to escape through a window and climb a ladder to his neighbours. When her family woke up from their afternoon nap, when Zari popped open her eyes and stretched, when Maman went into the kitchen to put the tea on the samovar, when Baba turned on the radio at 2 p.m, they would learn that the coup conspirators had overtaken the broadcasting station in Cimarron Avenue, that the crowd had attacked the Prime Minister's house, looted it, burned some of its contents, ran off with the rest, destroyed it. This time the coup had succeeded. This time the world had changed forever. But first, while her family still slept, Roya padded around the house in her ankle socks. Alone, she wept for Mr. Thackeray, for Bahman, for her new country. She did not even notice, nor would she have cared, that the white socks, the ones she had brought to meet Bahman again, so that they would get their marriage papers and be husband and wife, were now splattered red and blackened by smoke, stained with the blood of a man who had died at her feet as she had tried to find the man she loved. Part 2 covers 1916 and 1953. In 1916, rich 18-year-old Ali Thackeray has his whole life mapped out for him by his parents. He'll become a celebrated religious scholar just like his father, and he'll marry his second cousin. Ali, however, is obsessed with 14-year-old Padri, the poor melon seller's daughter, a person far beneath him in every way, socially and economically. The pair make love while everyone in the market is performing their noon prayers. Ali tries to bring up the new focus in his life with his father, but is laughed out of his father's study. Ali then abandons a pregnant Padri who is forced to self-abort her baby. Ali does marry his cousin, but opens a stationery shop to help other lovers to be together as a sort of penance. Padri manages to marry a rich engineer, Mr. Aslan, whose family promptly cut him off for marrying below his station. Padri suffers countless miscarriages before she eventually has Bahman. Mrs. Aslan, Padri, brings Bahman to meet Mr. Thackeray at the stationery shop. Back in 1953, a shell-shocked and grieving Roya gets Barman's final letter by mail, in which he tells her he's changed his mind and that she should move on. Padri, Mrs. Aslan, calls Roya to tell her that Bahman is getting married to Shala. A heartbroken and shocked Roya is persuaded by her father to apply for the newly created American scholarships open to Iranians. Roya and her sister Zari leave Tehran to study in America. Part 3. It's 1956 and Roya is homesick and heartsick. A student at Mills College, California, Roya is a chemistry major, in part to honor her father's faith in her ability to become a famous scientist. Roya and Zari live in a boarding house. They navigate the strange new foods and relationships of the US. Zari adapts very quickly, diving into American life, dating Jack, a beatnik poet and student at Berkeley. Roya yearns for Bahman, home and its foods. She feels out of place. Roya meets Walter by accident, knocking his coffee over one day. California and Berkeley is foreign to solid, upright New Englander Walter, as it is to Roya, both out of place in California. Roya, who begins to cook Persian food for Walter at the boarding house, fascinates him. A year later, Walter proposes and Roya accepts. That night, Roya tells herself, we are done with that boy for good, and that with time it would go away. But Roya has built walls around herself, kept part of herself locked away, that it's hard to break through for Walter. In Tehran, Bahman writes a letter to Roya he'll never send. He goes by Behistun Square after work every day. He sees the woman in red who waits for the lover who abandoned her. He also wants to turn back time so much. Bahman's mother's mood swings have decreased She's got low-level chronic sadness since the death of Mr. Thackeray, and his father, Mr. Aslan, has died. Barman recounts how his father was ostracized for marrying an illiterate padre for love. Others viewed his father as weak, but Barman knew he was strong to love and keep on loving Padre. Barman knows that Roya couldn't accept his mother's illness, but he wishes he'd fought harder to make her understand his mother's backstory, that he himself could get past the shame. Page 180. The day Jahangir told me you'd left, I felt like someone had torn off my skin. I couldn't even imagine California. But how amazing is that, Roya Jun, to think that you are there in the land of Cary Grant and Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart and Ernest Hemingway and President Eisenhower. I'm running out of Americans to mention. I won't mention the CIA. I'll be good. Though it still boils my blood to think that they had a hand in our coup, I want to be happy for you in America. And I am. But what the government of your new home did to us, one day it will be proven. One day the world will know that the government over there overthrew our government over here. For what? The lives lost, the suffering caused, was it worth it? I will never understand the turn of events for us in 1953. For you and me. I mean, let alone the whole damn country. If I live to be 100, I won't truly absorb it. We are, I think, a lost cause in this country. What did our generation learn that summer? That even if we did all the right things to bring about political change, in one day, one afternoon, foreign powers and corrupt Iranians can destroy it all. I have relieved that order of events on the 29th of Morad, 19th of August in your Western calendar, over and over and over again. Even now, I want to see you in that square, to feel you next to me, to hold you. We would have gone to the office of marriage and divorce. I had it all planned down to the minute when we would arrive at the office. The clerk I'd arranged with said he'd be ready with all the paperwork. Jahangir must have told you I work at the petroleum company now. Just another cog in the wheel of capitalism. We don't always match up with our expectation of who we want to be when we were younger. That's for sure. Mr. Thackeray, God bless his soul, used to call me the boy who would change the world. I think of the idealistic young boy I used to be, and I'm not embarrassed so much as bereft. I wish I could clean life of the sadness in all its crevices. I want to accept that you made the choices you made for a reason. You'll be a lady scientist after all. I hope you are healthy and happy. I truly do. And Roya Jun, believe it or not, I will become a father this winter. I thought Mother would be delighted at the news, but she's been surprisingly quiet and in retreat. When the baby is, God willing, born, it will have been 4.5 years since I waited for you at that square. Part 4 spans 1958 to 1963. Walter's at law school at Boston University, and Roya finally lands a job at Harvard Business School as an administrative assistant because no one will give a woman and an immigrant a job as a scientist, the thing that she is trained for. Walter's widowed mother welcomes Roya, but not his sister Patricia, who adores her baby brother and is borderline hostile to Roya. Not only does Patricia not like Persian food and brings her shoes into Roya's home, she questions most of Roya and Walter's family decision. Why does Roya need to work? And if she does so, who'll look after Walter? Why isn't Roya having a baby yet? In 1962, Roya and Walter have a baby girl, Marigold. Marigold smashes the barriers around Roya's heart. Marigold even manages to push Barman out. The romance of her youth fizzled in comparison to Marigold. When Roya held Marigold, she felt real again, fully herself. She lost all the layers of her reserve. The walls go back up again, and Marigold dies a year later. No one can reach her, not Zari, certainly not Walter. Patricia finally pierces Roya's heart by fully welcoming her into the family, by bringing Roya the Hafsen, seven things that begin with the letter S for the Persian New Year's. Roya grieves for Marigold all her life. Walter wants to have another child, but Roya doesn't want to open her heart again. Part 5 returns to 2013. Baby Kyle surprises Walter and Roya in their middle age. Kaya reawakens Roya. She quits her job, fastens her dream on him, and makes Kyle her sole purpose. Kyle eventually becomes a doctor. Roya and Walter settle into life, into middle life, into old age, into a life that is as comfortable as a pair of slippers. And then Roya finds Barman in the nursing home. After Roya's visit, Barman sends her a letter where he finally answers the question that Roya's been asking for so many years. Spoiler alert. Barman's letter recounts why he and his parents disappeared. They went away to their villa to help Mrs. Aslan recover from a suicide attempt. Barman just wanted a normal mother, but he didn't have a normal mother. As a consequence of her poverty, Mrs. Aslan wanted Barman to marry rich Sharla. She was also scared of losing Barman to Roya. After a mentally charged incident, Mrs. Aslan left the house. Barman ran after her but couldn't find her, so he went to the place he loved best, the stationery shop. He overheard Mr. Fekri and his mother arguing about the love affair, the aborted baby, and all the other lost children. Mrs. Aslan attempts to slit her throat. The family go away to the villa to let Mrs. Aslan heal her neck. There, she tells Barman, she'll attempt to kill herself if he marries Roya. Barman ignores his mother and goes to Barriston Square on August the 19th. He waits all afternoon in vain. Barman now realizes that Mr. Thackeray changed the name of the square from Barriston Square to Sepa Square in the letter that Roya received, because Mr. Thackeray owed Mrs. Aslan for abandoning her and their baby so many years ago. On page 282, Barman's letter continues. Even after I received your last letter requesting that I never see you again, never contact you, I never stopped loving you. And I hate to think about the possibility here, was that really what you wrote? Because now I just don't know. And my dearest Roya, when we met here at the centre last week, I could see in your eyes a certain worry that maybe I'd lost my mind or my memory. But please know this. I may not remember certain things, what I ate for lunch 2 days ago, or what dawn pill to take when. For that, I need Claire's guidance. But my mind is as sharp as a knife when it comes to remembering everything that happened that summer, when it comes to knowing my heart. The truth is, Roya June, I was never as happy as when I was with you. So many wonderful moments with my children, and yes, with Sharla, but I was never as happy as I was with you. There have been years when we were the first thing I thought about when I woke up. Just everything reminded me of you. Of course, I knew you would belong to another, as did I. But Roya, you have always been a part of me. Some things can't be helped. And now I find I must stop. It is when I think of the purple sky on the evening of our engagement and the moments we shared that I remember beauty in this world. But after what has happened to our country, and really, when I look around this modern world, I can't help but think there is an ugliness, a streak of cruelty in all of it. I have tried to remain positive, as the Americans so encourage. I have attempted not to be one of those grumpy old men. Claire here at Dunstan Center has been good to me. She calls me Mr. Batman. She doesn't tire of my stories. I have confided in her, even told her about our young love, the moments of beauty and connection to keep me going. I see my children and my grandchildren, and I am happy. The rest of it, the politics, the mental illness that drowned my mother, the cruel twists and turns, well, there is a fetid underside to life sometimes, and when I think that way is when I get the most helpless. I loved you then. I love you now. I will always love you. You are my love. Barman. Claire, Barman. Barman's friend and the nursing home administrator calls Roya to let her know that Barman is dying and to come quickly. Page 287. I missed you every single day, he said. I missed you too. As she said it, tears ran down her cheeks. She pulled her chair as close as possible to the bed and took his hand. It was dry and felt smaller than when she'd held it 2 weeks ago. A scent of pungent soil, a puddle of rain came from the vase of flowers on the nightstand, like something forgotten. She stood up. She balanced herself on her left foot, and then with everything she had, she hoisted herself up onto that bed. His eyes widened as she lay next to him. She put her arm across his body. They fit perfectly next to one another. How natural this felt, to lie beside him. She nuzzled her head into his shoulder. Roya Jun. The sheets smell like toothpaste. He smelled like the wind, like water and salt, like all their time together when they were young. In a parallel universe, the boy who had first shown her what it meant to fall in love, who promised he would wait for her, would always be hers. She was in the bed in the center, and she was pressed against the bookshelves for stolen kisses. She was in the both places all the time. He was always be right here. She held him under the toothpaste sheets and too in the pastry shops of a city long changed as they went through the lobby of Cinema Metropole with its red circular sofas to kiss under the sky. Before she knew it, they were in Jahangir's living room, familiar patterns of navy blue and white geometric shapes on the Persian rug as they practiced their dance steps. Look at me. Barman raised her chin gently. He interlaced his fingers with hers. The gramophone had a huge brass funnel through which tango music filled the room. Barman could not have known what to do. How did he know what to do? But he took charge. Their movements were clumsy at first. They couldn't get their feet in sync. Couples around them danced in as perspiration tickled down her spine. He held the small of her back. They caught the rhythm and then were one. It felt as though he carried her as they moved together in that hot living room. The music settled into the folds of Roya's green dress, landed in her hair. She was drunk on his scent. Together they swayed, their bodies against each other. He guided her face to his and kissed her. She thought it would have felt like flying, but no, it was like landing in a place soft and sweet. In the bed, beneath the toothpaste sheets, Roya stroked his chest, searched for his arms, the muscles she had known so well. She kissed his eyes, his cheekbones, his lips. She pressed her cheek against his heart and lay there, grateful for the time she had had with him, however short or long it had been. Grateful she had known him, grateful that once when she was young, she had experienced a love so strong that it did not go away, that decades and distance and miles and children and lies and letters could never make it disappear. She held him in her arms and said to him all she needed to say. For that fraction of time, he was entirely hers. Barman dies a couple of hours later. Roya and Claire go to Barman's memorial service. Roya wants to stay as long as possible to be with the people Barman loved, his son and daughter, and their memories of him. Mr. Vekri had once told Roya that Barman wanted to change the world, and Roya realizes that he did through his children. Roya takes a lonely Claire home, who gives Roya Barman's biscuit tin memento box containing all the letters he wrote to her but never sent, and all of Roya's letter, contents of her heart. Roya cooks Persian food for Claire, and Walter and Kyle join them for a lovely Persian meal. Roya realizes that there is no past, present, future. Roya was the woman she was today, and the 17-year-old girl in the stationery shop, always. She and Barman were one, and she and Walter were united. Kyle was her soul, and Marigold would never die. The book concludes by returning to August 19, 1953. Mr. Thackeray realizes the great harm he's about to do to Royer and Barman, and to his own legacy of uniting lovers at the stationery shop. He rushes out to tell Royer, but is shot. I really adored this book. I enjoyed reading a story that was set in a historical moment that's not many Americans are aware of or familiar with, and I especially loved getting to know a Tehran most Americans really don't know. When I was in middle school, the miniseries The Thornbirds with Richard Chamberlain was on. It was all the rage, and it made me cry my heart out. The missed opportunities of Maggie and Father Ralph. Was it Father Ralph? I'll have to look that up. Anyway, gosh, it still brings a tear to my eyes. My dad thought I had totally lost it. Blubbering is not a good look for me. Anyway, I had the similar reaction to the stationery shop. Lots of tissue really tugging at your heart. I finished the book over a couple of nights. The book's five-part format is really conducive to reading over a period of days, and so I really did enjoy it. One of the interesting aspects of this book for me was the juxtaposition of Royer and Barman's dream as a couple and the aspirations of Iran, the country, how they kind of ran together. Under Mossadegh's brief rule, so really if you want to think about it, the period when Royer and Barman are together, there's a freshness, an invigorating joy, energy and passionate confidence to everything, and so that everything and anything really can be achieved, both in the dreams of the couple and the dreams of Iran. After Mossadegh's ouster, and when Royer and Barman break up, there's a settling in, an acceptance of how things are, a monotony, a dreariness, a mundaneness that enters into life, a sense of just sort of existing, being alive, but not really fully living. The stationery shop tackles themes of obsession, subterfuge, loss, and its reverberations, shattered dreams, and the push and pull of fully living your life or just existing in it. Barman and Royer have their dreams shattered by people they trusted and believed in, but interestingly, those same people, Mrs. Aslan and Mr. Thackeray, have also had their dreams and lives destroyed by socioeconomic, the system, the Iranian system, Mr. Thackeray's parents, and Mr. Thackeray's own moral cowardice. Poor Mr. Thackeray spends the better part of the story trying to make amends for his poor treatment of Mrs. Aslan. One of my favourite characters in the stationery shop is Walter, the New Englander, Roy's husband. He is stoic, matter-of-fact, quite willing to ignore facts he doesn't like, sort of, a total New Englander. I just loved Walter, how he got totally excited by having frozen fish sticks for dinner, a real treat. I love fish sticks, my husband not so much. Anyway, ultimately, though, I did feel a great sadness for both Walter, Mr. Aslan, and even Sharla, who actually feel the reverberation of the shattering of the dreams from their partners and its ramifications. Additionally, Iran's dream of self-sufficiency, democracy, and uplift for its citizens is destroyed by outside players, the Americans and the British, who think they know best. Iran's population is betrayed not only by their own citizens, but also by a country that they trusted, the USA. It's interesting that even after the coup, though, Royer's father still cannot believe that America would be involved in taking down a democratically elected prime minister. But Iran, like our protagonists, stoically keep living. In many ways, Barman actually, for me, represented Mossadegh himself. Mossadegh was honest, idealistic, incorruptible, and very charismatic, according to all the Shah's men. And he respected the civil liberties of all groups within Iran, the communists, the Islamists, and the monarchists. And so Mossadegh believed in the democratic process, in dialogue, in the same way that Barman actually tries to engage and placate his mother's concern. He doesn't actually bang on, head on deal with her. So I'm not sure that worked well for both Mossadegh and Barman in the whole scheme of things. When I teach history, one of the things I stress is the human connections that people can make. Yes, country to country may be antagonists, governments against other governments. So here Iran and the US are in subterfuge, if you want to say. But ultimately, it's the connection between the people of the countries that where the real change happens. So a people-to-people kind of dialogue. And I really loved how the book utilizes that people-to-people dialogue. So Walter and Roya's relationship, as well as Claire and Barman's relationship, really speak to that people-to-people connection. I love the food in this book. There's descriptions of food, and I'm a real foodie, and the Persian food in the stationery shop is just amazing. It just made me salivate so much. Actually, I'm going to be looking at Persian cookbooks online just after I finish this. Oh my God, the Persian tea, the baklava, the alabu, the sour cherry rice, the Qureshi badam. I'm totally pronouncing that wrong. Just some of the amazing food that's described with such wondrous love in this book. Marjan Kamali has a really wonderful voice, and she has another book called Together Tea, which I will be checking out. Here are some book club questions. Mrs. Aslan was impacted profoundly by her miscarriages, and Roya was crushed by Marigold's death. How did each of these women cope with these difficult situations? How were you able to overcome losses and disappointments in your own life? How has mental health been addressed and approached through different historical periods and different cultures? And how can we better advocate for mental health illness and prevention in our culture? If the CIA coup in Iran had not taken place, what do you think the US-Iranian relationship would be like today? And how did the coup change everything, as Bauman says, for Iran and for the US? Barman's youthful dreams for himself did not match his expectations. Have your dreams matched your expectations? Roya connected with her mother by helping her prepare the wonderful Persian meals and food. What does it say about Roya that she seems not to enjoy American food and has never learnt to eat like Americans? What does food mean to you? And what memories do you associate with certain foods? Do you think Roya thinks of herself as an American or an Iranian? And how long do you really need to live in a place to belong or call it home? If Marigold had lived, do you think Roya would still have room in her heart for Barman? Do you think Roya romanticized Barman? If they had got married, do you think their love would have still been as passionate as it was when they were young, or would it have changed? I hope you have a chance to read The Stationery Shop and also All the Shah's Men. Bye-bye.